Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? How's it going? This is Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. Welcome to the show. Hope you're doing well. I hope you're doing well globally. I hope all my friends around the world are doing well. Everyone who's listening to this in all these different countries. I just got back from Australia this morning, and I'm out of my fucking mind. I was only there long enough just almost to adjust to the difference in time, which is like 15, 16 hours ahead of where I am now. So I flew back in time this morning, and I'm fucking out of my mind. But I got to be honest with you, given all my panic and fear and everything else, I mean this, I had some of the best shows of my life in Australia this last trip. I don't know what it was. Maybe it had something to do with the jet lag. I don't know if you know how I work, but I flew out there, and I talked to you right when I got there. But later that day, I went and did television. I slept for like 3 hours. And then that night, that Wednesday night in Melbourne, I got to do the Project Live, which is a panel show. So I get there. I'm fragmented on sleep. I ate a Cadbury Dairy Milk Bar, amazing British chocolate, I believe it is. I had a bunch of coffee. All the coffee there is espresso based. There's no just regular drip coffee. So I jammed myself up with sugar and caffeine, and I went on TV in Melbourne, Australia, killed it. And I don't say that about myself much, but it was good. So I went back, crashed out, and then the next morning we flew to Sydney after I did another TV show in Australia, a morning program with two anchors, man and woman. That went pretty good. Got on a plane for Sydney, got there, and they had all this candy in the fucking mini bar. So I just went to sleep for 3 hours, ate a giant piece of chocolate with marshmallows and then some other chocolate, then drank a bunch of coffee, and I headed over to the State Theater in Sydney, nervous because, as you know, I got a little anxious about the trip because I didn't know if we were selling tickets and there was some panic. Apparently, everyone who likes me in Australia bought their tickets immediately months ago, and then very few people bought them after that. But the fact of the matter is, I got there, got this Michael Hing guy opening for me, did a great job. The State Theater is an amazing theater. It's one of the most beautiful theaters I've ever seen, really, in Sydney. And holy shit, there's about 1,100 people there, which is fine. Even if the place seats more, it was fine, and they were into it. And I don't know if it was jet lag or what, but I rambled through. I should give myself more credit. I professionally rambled through about 2 hours and change, did a little Q&A in the middle for no fucking reason, just feeling it out, feeling the jet lag. The thing about jet lag is you feel, it's a combination of feelings. You feel hungover, but then you know, when you feel that, and I know I don't drink, it's like being hungover with having nothing fun to regret. It's just the travel, and you're fucked up, and you're kind of queasy, and your brain's not quite fucking working. But I did like 2 hours and 10 minutes, and it was fun, and the audience was great. It was a great show. It was one of the better shows I've ever done. Next day, we fly back to Melbourne. I go to sleep again, eat some more chocolate, drink some more coffee, and then I go to the Palais Theater right by the water. It's this damp, kind of smelly old theater. It's pretty stunning, though, but it's dark. It's got the haunted vibe. It's sort of like, yeah, there was a lot of stuff that went on here, and
I don't know what you got, but yeah, I'm a little exhausted as a structure. And that's how I felt that theater was. You turn the lights on that theater and it goes like, oh, what's happening now? Again, what is it this time? Is it music or some needy guy? My opener, Ann Edmonds, did great. And I got out there and I was kind of, I project onto it. This old haunted structure with about 1,200 people in it, plenty of room. I began to look at it as sort of an experimental art piece, exploring the empty space of theater. But it didn't matter. They were, both those theaters were so hot and the crowds were so good. I did, and the Stones played there in 65. And I did another two-hour show, but this one was pretty fucking tight. And it was really one of the best shows I ever did in my life. It was very exciting. Then the next day, fly to Brisbane, which I was nervous about because this was the show I almost canceled because the tickets weren't selling. I sold about $350, $375. And then they found a room in the same structure. It's in the actual City Hall of Brisbane. So after doing these two huge theaters and really just putting on big shows for me, all of a sudden I was in this intimate space and I was just stripped bare. The jet lag had ripped me open and the shows had ripped me open. And I was almost too fragile in some ways to do the show, but it made the show even more exciting, more interesting. And Mel Buttle, who opened for me, was hilarious. And we're just in this conference room in City Hall. It was all good. And I have to tell you, Australia, I apologize. And I have to tell the people that are listening. I had no time to do fucking anything, sightsee or nothing. Just eat food, eat chocolate, drink coffee, sleep erratically, and do shows. 3 days I was in fucking Australia. It's a hell of a trip for 3 days, but it was great. I want to thank the people of Australia and thank everybody for the amazing momentum we moved towards Australia with. I wish I'd stayed longer because the other thing about jet lag is now it just seems like a fucking dream. I don't even know if I was there. You just feel like you're moving through waking consciousness, a dream that you have just a little bit of control over, but your brain is still firing like you're asleep. So everything just sort of fades quickly. And it's very weird in Australia. There's a lot of people, a lot of different kinds of people, but there seems to be this large tribe of spiky haired alpha males who seem preoccupied with various types of football playing. Maybe I'm projecting, but they all look kind of similar. They all look like they're on a mostly protein diet and would probably smile while they hit your face. But maybe I'm projecting. Thank you, Australia, is what I'm trying to say. Now, look, today on the show, I've got a guy I really like a lot. I love his music. Michael Cronin will be here. He'll play a song. And then my buddy Patrick Stickles from Titus Andronicus just happened to be down the street, and I snagged him. So that's going to happen in a minute. Here, let's start doing this. We're heading into the Lorne Michaels episode. It's in the future a bit, but we're heading into it. And we're going back through the history of the show to sort of hear from guests that know Lorne and to get a real sense of how Lorne has loomed over so much of what we do as comedians. And it looms large in my mind. I don't know how much he had to do with what I do, but it's certainly been an obsession of mine. So we've been sort of kind of going through the back episodes to get these Lorne stories. And there's a lot of them. There's like three or four special episodes of just Lorne stories if we really wanted to do it. But as we head into my new experience with Lorne Michaels, I want to play this clip. This is from 2011. This is from episode 164. It was a live show from Brooklyn at the Bell House that included Bill Hader and Fred Armisen.
How often do you have to deal with Lorne?
Like one every
day,
all the time. He's
the
awesome.
Time.
Yeah, he really is hands great. On. He's very hands on, and he's very.
Can I share with you how paranoid I am?
Yeah.
I had one meeting with him.
When?
Like 95 or something, and it didn't go well. And like I think he brought me in was when Luna was starting downtown, and like the first thing he said to me was like, "I don't know what you think you're doing down there below 14th Street, but it doesn't matter."
It didn't matter, did it?
No, it didn't matter at all. But this is how fucking nuts I am and how self-important I am. It's like the Wall Street Journal wrote up this show, and I told the interviewer who was asking me about Luna and that you guys were coming on, and then I told him about the SNL story, and I told him that story because he was asking me about alternative comedy, and I called him back. And I said, look, could you pull the Learn thing out? Because I don't want him to see it and then say, and then keep Fred and Bill late. Like, I thought Lorne Michaels was going to see that story and say, you guys aren't going.
You're not going to the Fable WTM.
Wow.
That's crazy.
That's a good move, though.
That is. I mean, that is a good move.
You did the right thing.
You did do the right thing. No, yeah. I mean, there's certain things, like, he'll laugh really hard at, like, anytime, like, Will Forte would get angry in a sketch, Lorne would start laughing really hard. And Will's face would get red and be like, what the fuck is it?
Yeah.
Like, he would just, like, that was, like, Lorne's sweet spot. Lorne would just start laughing. He would see it on the horizon.
Yeah, yeah.
But does that make everybody feel good? Like, does Will come back and go, I fucking made the king laugh?
Yeah. Or you do hear that sometimes. You'll go back to the office and be like, Lorne was laughing.
Yeah, that's a point. That's a point after read through. It's like, man, Lorne.
Or you're doing something, you look up and he's not laughing and you're like, oh, no.
Has he ever given you any weird notes? Like, that just made you go, oh, okay.
Sometimes you have to, like, think, like, what does he mean by that?
Uh-huh.
It's that kind of thing. But they're always constructive.
He'll do weird psych-out thing. Not weird psych, but I think he's being honest, but it becomes a psych. Like, the very first Vincent Price we did, I came up, and he was, like, there's a band's playing. I'm dressed as Vincent Price. I'm sitting there. I'm, like, really nervous. I'm kind of, it's, like, my fifth show or something. And he came up to me. He's like, I like this, but why now?
Was this?
And I was like, why did you just say I'm about to go live? And he's like, no, it's good. I like it. I mean.
Yeah, man. See, Lorne has had the zap on my head for a long time. And you're going to hear where we stand, him and I, now, and what gets hashed out soon, my friends. All right, let's talk Stickles. Patrick Stickles. Patrick Stickles is the front man of Titus Andronicus. You might have heard him here on episode 462. It was one of my favorites. The guy's mind is on fire. He's got a brain on fire all the time. I like guys like that. And here's what happened. He's got this amazing new triple record out. It comes with three vinyl discs, full 12-inch vinyl. One of them, you got to play at 45. Keeps you on your toes. But it's a rock opera. And we had talked about him doing this rock opera when he was on a couple years ago. And I just liked his records. I don't even know where I got his records, The Monitor and Local Business. And I just felt that he meant it, man. He means it. He's got to play rock and roll to live mentally and physically. If it doesn't get out of him, we're all in trouble. So I liked his drive. And I was excited to have him on the show. So here's what happens. He gave me the test pressings of this vinyl when I did my show at BAM in Brooklyn. He came backstage. He was going to come to the show, but he got there an hour and a half, 2 hours late. But he brought me these test pressings, and he gave them to me as a gift, which was great. But I got the vinyl. I got the CD of The Most Lamentable Tragedy. That's the name of the rock opera from Titus Andronicus. It's her first album on Merge Records. You can get it at mergerecords.com/shop and use the promo code WTF at checkout to get 20% off all music and merch. Also, you can hear my full episode with Patrick. And as I told you before, it was episode 462, and you can get that on HAL Premium. So Patrick Stickles is in town, tells me he's coming to town. He's playing at the Roxy. I can't make it. That day, though, I'm driving down New York Boulevard in my neighborhood, and out in front of Permanent Records, I see a bearded Stickles just hanging out talking to people. I'm like, what the fuck? I knew he was in town. I didn't know he was doing an in-store at Permanent, but they had just done it, and I pulled over, and I see him. He's just on fire. The dude is just, like, mentally on fire and full of the spirit of rock and roll and trying to crunch the big existential numbers in his head at all times. So I said, hey, man, why don't you come over tomorrow and hang out on the mic for a bit? And he's like, yeah. So this is a sort of impromptu conversation with Patrick Stickles from Titus Andronicus. And he also just informed me that his new music video is going to be premiering, I believe, today at TitusAndronicus.net. All right? Okay? I'm telling you that now. And now you're going to hear me talk to Stickles. Where the fuck is that ashtray? I used to have this ashtray. Hold on.
That's it. I just want to thank everybody for tuning in to What the Fuck with me, your host, Patrick Stickles, coming to you from the garage that you all have imagined so many times. I just want to let you know that it is real. It's a real place. So what's going on? Let's just work some shit out. Let me tell you, driving around this neighborhood with a big trailer is tough. Can I tell you, folks? I sure scared myself a few times trying to park that thing on those hills. All right, my guest today is Mark Maron.
Hold on.
You might know him from Dr. Katz, professional therapist, and he's...
All right. I did it. Patrick Stickles.
Hello, hello.
Here in the garage again.
What an honor to be back here. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I'm sorry that I missed the fucking show.
That's all right. That was vengeance for me missing your show at the Brooklyn.
But you did show up very excited and, late. And you gave me the, what was that, the test pressing?
That's right.
Of the masterpiece. Of the masterwork.
If you want to call it that.
Yeah, I mean, look at this thing, man. The most lamentable tragedy. A 3-album rock opera.
Yes, although to be fair to your listeners, one of those LPs is a 12-inch 45.
I know, and it forces you to listen in order. I noticed that today.
That's right. Well, and not in the order that exactly. People would think. It's trying to make a more active listening experience rather than the whole put it on, make dinner kind
sure.
of.
Sure. Does more active mean like, oh, fuck, wait, so this isn't the... All right. Well, okay, so I guess I put this one on.
Well, the... It's trying to keep people on their toes, basically. You know, you listen to the first LP, it's just two sides of 33 and a third. That's very normal. And then when you go to reach for the first side of the next disc, if you don't adjust the speeds, the track will be playing a lot slower. And this is one of the ways that we indicate that we've entered into a dream sequence, because it's like an altered reality.
Is that 45 supposed to be an altered reality?
That's a dream sequence, yes.
And that's the one with the, my father's brother song?
That's right. That's the ancestor of the main character, like his great-great-grandfather or something, who is the original person in his family to emigrate to America.
From
the old country.
Which old country? Any?
It's Ireland.
Yeah.
But it could be mostly any country. Any country where, you know, dreams have been dashed and where, you know, a happy future seems impossible.
It seems to me after I talked to you last that you working through a lot of your own shit in this record.
Yes.
I mean,
yes, that's true.
The journey through medication, through the meltdown, through, owning your brain, owning yourself. And for better or for worse, warning people of the possibilities of personality trouble.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah.
That's right. And when I told you all these things the first time, I didn't realize that you discussed these same things often in your own work.
Yeah, yeah.
I was pretty ignorant coming into the whole thing, aside from the Dr. Katz episodes, which I enjoyed very much.
Yeah. Well, no, yeah, we talk about that shit a lot. But, I remember... Because the last time I talked to you, you were kind of fresh out of the fucking whirlpool.
Yeah.
Fresh out of the...
Well, I thought so.
Yeah.
I thought I was out of the whirlpool. I thought I was on the other side of something with
you were like, no medicine guy. I'm just going to smoke some weed.
Yeah, well, I was back in a doctor's care about a month later. So to be fair.
And what happened?
Well, you know, I guess you could say that, some of those decisions were possibly a little bit selfish, you know, and maybe a lot of them came from a genuine place of concern or self-preservation or, you know, a desire to not extinguish my artistic tendencies or whatever, and to feel life.
Yeah.
But this is one of the morals of that rock opera we just talked about, you know, those are all valid things, but ultimately... That's your business, and you're still accountable for the decisions that you make
and how they affect other people.
Them. Yes, exactly.
Right.
You know, it's not even though I'm fighting my own personal little war against myself.
Yeah.
You know, there shouldn't be so many casualties in that struggle.
No. You know? No,
inevitably,
no.
There are.
Oh boy, did you lose some people?
Not even really.
Oh really?
I'm a very lucky guy.
You pulled
but I
back.
I know that I, you know. Hey,
yeah,
everybody out there has heard this this tale before that's tuning into this program, you know, to be just.
But I don't know, you know.
Around,
but the thing is,
angry man style, you know.
But I've heard that you may have heard the tale before. But like the thing that's great about the record and about how you deal with it is that this is the struggle is definitely on this record and in the songs themselves. You read the lyrics because it's a fucking. If you get the vinyl, it's a beautiful bit of business.
Quadruple gatefold designed by the great artist Nolan Strauss of Baltimore, Maryland.
It's great.
Former singer of the great band Double Dagger. You ever heard them?
No, good.
One of the greatest of all time, and he plays in a really good, awesome band now called Pure Junk.
Yeah.
Nolan Strauss. I tip my hat to him.
And
every
he did
time.
A beautiful layout, did some beautiful art, and all the lyrics are here.
Although I did the lettering for the lyrics, not to brag.
And also, you did the lettering for your famous logo, I guess, too. Huh? No? Not you?
No. And I didn't design that logo either. That was our former keyboardist, David Robbins.
What happened to that guy? Was he one of the fallen?
Burned him out, basically. You know, yeah. He was a wonderful guy. He was like a beautiful soul. You know?
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways.
Too sensitive for the stickles.
I mean, maybe, yeah. I don't know if it was, I contributed to it. But it's the life, you know, I don't necessarily make the life easier on people, but I'd like to.
I don't know, man. I think that if, the record's doing well, the response is good, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that a lot of people identify with the struggle. And with the, you know, with the drugs, with the, you know, wanting to be yourself, with the, you know, not wanting to be on drugs, with the thinking that you can manage your own shit, and then sort of drifting into fantasy and kind of coming through it a bit on the other side. You seem okay today.
Yeah, well, I'm in a much better place than when we first met.
Medicine? No medicine?
Yes, medicine. I take 100 milligrams of Lamictal a day, and then I've got the Klonopin as needed.
Yeah.
But as needed is a very elastic term, right?
That's a slippery slope with the Klonopin.
Take it when you're anxious. Well, all right. So 9 a.m., let's go. I'm plenty fucking anxious, you know? But like, that's
I like
one
you
of
got the wiggle room on the Klonopin.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I shouldn't, though, is the thing.
Well, I know, but Lamictal, what is it? That's bipolar.
That's an anticonvulsant, yeah.
Right, so
I spent a lot of my life convulsing, so I still do my fair share.
You do a lot of it on stage, though, thank God.
I try to keep it up there as much as I can.
Well, so the Lamictal's not going to bring the poles together. It's just going to try to level the highs, so when they get too out of control, you knock it down with the Klonopin.
I suppose so. I mean, I guess, yeah, that would be the plan.
Right.
I suppose.
Because the choice other than that is lithium, which will suck the balls right out of you.
Right.
You know Richard Thompson's work, the guitar player?
I've heard of him, you know, well, but I haven't done all my homework yet.
Well, it's all right. He's a good guitar player, but I ran into him in Ireland, and I had interviewed him, and I was backstage talking to him, and I told him that I smoked a cigarette with Keith Richards, and I said, you know, Keith is a bad influence on me, and Richard Thompson says, he was a bad influence on everyone. That's the rock and roll hero,
yeah,
though.
I wonder if the choices that I would have made had I not...
Done.
Studied his life as much as I have the past few years.
Who, Keith?
Keith, yeah.
Oh, really?
I mean, Keith Richards, like, if he had done the things that he had done and not the rock and roll genius part.
Right.
Like, what, you know? You know what I'm saying?
Who
like
would
that,
care?
Like Keith Richards or like Neil Young or somebody. Can make lots of sorts of decisions,
yeah,
and come out on the other side looking like they were right.
Right.
But then again, they also, you know, wrote Jumpin' Jack Flash,
yeah,
or whatnot.
Down by the River.
Yeah, and yeah. So they can mostly back up, like, history is going to forgive a lot of the things that they did.
And maybe, yeah, that's right. And it may just feed their myth, you know, even if it was kind of gnarly.
What's his famous thing? I never had a drug problem. It was the cops that had a problem with my drugs or something, right?
Well, now he says that the entire drug experience was experimentation. But he's pretty honest about it. He knows he's lucky to be alive, and he saw a lot of people die. And I think right now, old Keith is just trying to make people realize that whatever they think he is, that's about a 30-year-old story. You know, the truth of the matter is, you know, he's a 72-year-old dude with grandkids, and he's still alive and making music.
As long as we're talking about him and I have this platform,
yeah.
I just want to say real fast that his daughter, Alexandra Richards,
yeah.
She and I have the same birthday,
okay.
July 28th, okay? I was 1985, she was 1986.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to also say that she was photographed in the pages of Self magazine holding the Titus Andronicus record Local Business. And that may have just been because it was a red vinyl prop.
Uh-huh.
But then again, maybe not. Same birthday.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I can find out if she likes you.
I would appreciate
you
it.
You want to know?
I got away. Not really. I want her to like us.
Okay.
I want the
so
whole.
You
want
to mystery?
I want to. Well, no. I'm getting up here and I'm just saying to the world, yeah. Like, there's a connection here, folks. Like, there's the will of the universe.
Yeah.
Is trying to make itself known. Okay.
Yeah.
We got the same birthday and the video for Trouble from Cross Eyed Heart. That dropped on July 27th,
okay?
So maybe Keith didn't know. Maybe that was intended as a present for his daughter, but that was my 30th birthday present this year. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, new Keith Richards video, and he watching Keith's hands going just like they should, and it's like, oh, man, that was a great birthday, you know? But I'm just saying, I guess I'll just come right out and say it. It is because you got to, like, visualize what you want, right? And you got to make, like, your vision chart for the things you want.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the expensive winos and Keith are probably going to go play some shows, he said.
Mm-hmm.
He said that there'll probably be some expensive winos shows.
Yeah.
And what a great band. Steve Jordan on drums, fantastic. Yeah. Anyway, I really think that if these shows do happen, that Titus Andronicus should be the opening act.
Okay.
I'm just putting it out there.
It's out there.
Alexandra Richards and I have the same birthday. Nobody out there has studied as much as I have in our little field anyway. Maybe like some much older guys, but come on.
Yeah. Come on, Keith.
Come on, Keith.
Let's throw Patrick a bone.
Let's do it, man. Like, you would think I was cool.
Yeah, I think you would, man.
Come on. And Alexandra, this birthday thing, you already held the record. Let's go. Let's make this happen. Like, Connecticut is pretty close to New York City. That's where we live.
Yeah.
Whatever. Fuck this show. It's like, we'll come over the house.
Jam.
Not even jam. We could just sit around and smoke cigarettes.
I think you guys would get along. He likes to talk. Smart guy. You like to talk. You're a smart guy.
Well, maybe I should talk less, listen more.
Really? Maybe that's part. Is that going to be the new Stickles?
Well, no, because then I would be out of a job.
Yeah.
You do both of them.
Yeah.
It seems. How do you do it?
I just force myself to shut up.
God,
it's hard. It's hard. It took a long time of talking to people and realizing that I didn't need to fucking talk. You know, like sometimes it's like, all right, just don't talk.
Well, yeah, like...
Yeah, just what's in.
You don't have to always fill the void.
Well, yeah, it's hard, though, man.
So
you played the Roxy, and you said coming in that, you know, that you got the same number of people that Bruce did. Where was that math?
Except for the VIP section. Our VIP section was barren. Except for maybe, like, two people who had a whole bunch of elbow room. But then the dance floor...
But that's a testament to perhaps being, you know, at that point in your life where it's just real rock and roll and the VIPs are not hip.
That would be nice.
They're not hip yet.
If the hip, well, I mean, the VIPs, maybe they can just skip it.
Yeah, who needs the VIPs, man? Would it make you feel better if Lemmy was in the corner?
Oh, well, Lemmy is a different sort of VIP or Iggy or anybody like that.
Yeah.
It's different, but like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I wouldn't mind... some like network executive or something, or you know, came to the show and gave me the same deal you got.
Sure,
I wouldn't mind that if they wanna put me on TV or in the movies or something. They can stand back there, but
you want to be in the movies?
No, not really. But let me put it this way.
Yeah.
Last night at the Roxy Theater. I'm quite a big fan of Bruce Springsteen, okay? I'll admit it. I'm from New Jersey just like he is. He has a very legendary concert recording from the Roxy, July 7th, 1978. It was the source of most of the first disc of his live 1975-85 box set.
Uh-huh.
And so that was what we were playing over the PA last night between the bands, Baked from Brooklyn and Spider Bags from North Carolina. It behooves me to mention these great artists. Anyway, and at the beginning of the concert, Bruce gets out there and says something like, I know that a lot of people waited a long time online to get tickets for this show. A lot of people didn't get in. I don't play no private parties anymore.
Uh-huh.
I only play my own parties now.
Yeah,
let's rock. And so that's what it is, you know. Like, and attracting these VIPs or whoever, these cultural tastemakers, you know, these people that have got the keys, that have got access to the apparatus of the industry.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's just a. Present company excluded, obviously. Yeah. That's like a means to an end, you know what I'm saying? To reach the people that are going to fill up the dance floor.
Right.
You know, because these VIPs, you know, maybe, you know, we might have been the hottest ticket in town last night. Probably not. I think Kanye West or somebody was in town, who I admire very much too. But, you know, if all those people were saying, I need to be in there tonight because this is the hottest ticket in town, well, you know, where are these people going to be in 2 years when it's not the hottest ticket in town? You know what I'm saying? It's much more important to foster and nurture the connection with the people who...
love you.
Yeah, who have a real genuine connection to the art and aren't concerned with the status that comes along with it. And if they're trying to be part of any scene, it's just the scene around the band, you know, because it's a beautiful communal, the whole rock and roll thing. Everybody together is like a little family for one night and a little temporary autonomous zone.
Taz,
yeah.
Yeah, Hakeem Bey.
That's pretty good. That's not such a bad acronym.
Yeah, no, it's a real acronym. There's a book, Autonomy Media put out a book by a guy named Hakeem Bey called Taz, Temporary Autonomous Zone.
God.
I might dig
it up talking,
for you.
I've been talking about it for years. I didn't even know where it came from. Well, I know I didn't make up that phrase.
Yeah, I'll show you the book after. I might have it still.
That's an important concept right now in the movement to make the rock and roll / punk scene less violent and more inclusive to people, you know, who maybe can't or don't want to participate in those kinds of like macho.
Right. Beat the shit out of everybody.
Yeah.
On the dance floor.
Yeah.
Get yourself bloody.
I mean, you know, even if it's not, even if people aren't breaking their nose every single night, like with certain so-called punk bands.
Yeah.
Like, it still has often been the case that, you know, a show will begin and in the front row will be a lot of people that I'm really very interested in sharing my secret feelings with. Not that I'm trying to, like, play super favorites. I mean, I am, you know, but meeker people, you know, who I know are probably there to, you know, to be like an aficionado, you know what I'm saying? And want to be, you know, at the front of the stage to feel what it's all about.
The struggle,
you know?
Dude.
Yeah. But then, you know, a lot of the times, you know, they'll be there and they'll be singing along for some kind of sensitive, pensive opener and something. And I'm like, wow, this is the life, man. Like, I feel so, there's so much mutual validation going on. I feel so safe and loved and they feel the same, I know. And then it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, bana, into some giant hit. And in 30 seconds, it's all shirtless frat boys. And nothing against those people, you know, because I might not have been in a fraternity, but I've been like definitely a dumb punk bro that like made the scene less inclusive just by, you know, thinking that, oh, I'm just going wild and this is the way to go. And that's fine, you know, like, but it's like there's questions of affirmative consent. Uh-huh. You know what I'm saying?
It
shouldn't be taken for granted that if you step onto the dance floor at a punk show, or if you're in the front row because you want to be by the amplifiers or whatever, you want to be
beat up.
Well, that's not signing up to get pummeled, clobbered.
But I like that you're such a fan of Bruce because, and I don't know if we talked about this the last time, but there's always, you're really good at knocking out the anthems, building up the pace.
Right.
Getting it going. Like, I like, because like whatever punk rock is, you know, I've talked to like people who are part of the original punk thing where it meant something a little different, but you just play fucking rock and roll songs, dude.
That's right. Well, there's a distinction for me between punk, the ideology, mm-hmm. and punk rock music. Because right. like you said, the first wave has got certain aesthetic signifiers.
It was just meant different.
Attached to it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was different from the dominant culture right. at that time, which was very excessive.
Yeah.
So they said we have to be more economical. Whatever the Ramones sure. were doing, you know?
Yeah.
Because like you said, we mostly just play rock and roll.
It's great, man. And everything kind of weaves into the next. You always did that, though. I mean, you know, the monitor is like close to an opera in mm-hmm. a way. And you know,
well, that doesn't have a linear narrative, right. exactly.
But it's a definitely a concept
got a frame,
record.
A frame story and then kind of a more series of vignettes. More well, like Born to Run in that way, as, yeah. long as, we're, as long as we're given credit where it's due to the boss.
But The River, too, is sort of a concept, right? He's made a few.
Right. Well, I thought a lot more about The River when making that one.
Your new one.
Yeah, just because I didn't get that one for a lot of years because it has a certain bipolar quality to it, you know what I'm saying? It's got like Sherry Darling right next to, you know, Point Blank or whatnot.
Yeah.
Or you know, the yeah. super dark songs, like some of his darkest, bleakest stuff right next to like his most uplifting, joyous stuff. And I was like, what's up with that?
Yeah.
And I see now, and I had to have it explained to me by a couple different books, but I see that that's a kind of a richer experience than, say, Darkness on the Edge of Town.
Right.
Which is like purely bleak. Like it's very, you know, finely distilled sort of a thing, but it has, it's sort of a little bit one-dimensional. And I would have to level the same accusation at, you know, most of the Titus Andronicus albums prior to this one that you're holding there.
Yeah.
Because I thought that it would be very corny to sing about, say, romance or to write a song that says, hey, everything actually is going to be okay. You know, mm-hmm. I've always had moments like that.
Yeah.
I didn't see how they could fit into my particular artistic purpose. But that, hence the rock opera and the emotional camouflage of the so-called fictional story.
And also, when you got three records, you can just, you document the perseverance of the human spirit.
Exactly. That's and then, how you glimpse real transcendence.
That's it, know? Buddy. Well, you did it, man.
I'm trying.
Well, I'm glad we talked for a little while.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for all your support over the years.
Sure, man.
Thank you for all the laughs. Thank you for all the validation.
Yeah, and thank you for the original test pressings of The Most Lamentable Tragedy.
Hey, you know, I know you're vinyl guy.
It was sweet, buddy. It's great to see you, Patrick.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Mark.
So don't forget to pick up that album, The Most Lamentable Tragedy, and if you get it at mergerecords.com/shop, use the promo code WTF to get 20% off. It's a good record, people. I mean it. He means it. Stickles means it. Titus means it. Michael Cronin. He's one of Ty Siegel's buddies. I loved his last record, MC2, and now there's MC3. And he's on Merge Records too. So you can go to mergerecords.com/shop, and that's 20% off with the WTF promo code. But I was always sort of curious about Michael Cronin. I thought he was some sort of wizard. I thought he was older than he was. I thought a lot of things about Michael Cronin. And then he comes, he's like, he's just this guy, just this young dude who happens to play really fucking great music. But he does the full spectrum. He'll do some noise music, he'll do some psychedelic music, and then these records, these last couple of records, good rock pop. He lives down the street. So here's me talking to Michael Cronin. So we're inside, and I told you I watched the Eagles documentary. Now, like, I'm on neither side of this fight, the Eagles fight.
Me too.
You're in the middle?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind it when it comes on, but
right.
I don't actively hate it.
Right. Like, I don't understand what makes some bands cool for hipsters. Like, the bands that those guys came from, kind of like that whole, the Birds and, well, that's weird. It's the Birds and the Flying Burritos Brothers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're cool.
Yeah.
But Linda Ronstadt, the Eagles, not cool.
Not cool.
How the fuck does that happen?
I don't know.
You said you witnessed an argument?
It seems to keep coming up. The
really?
Eagles.
Recently?
I think because some young people seem to be getting into them a little. Maybe. I don't know.
Oh, so now
I'm not on the cusp of
no,
the
me neither.
Cool music.
But I mean, just the idea of that's kind of interesting to me. So there's some hipster arguments.
Some heated discussion.
Like one idiot, you know,
with some fancy glasses goes, I don't know, I think the Eagles are okay. And some guy goes, no, Eagles.
I think it'll come back around. It's like Fleetwood Mac seemed to get cool again a couple years ago. Like Lance and Liz down at Permanent Records, they say like they sell at least one or two a day all of a sudden.
Really? You know? Well, that's because like a lot of the people that are buying records are fucking old guys like me trying to find some part of our life that we lost. There's nothing more humbling than being in a record store going through bins with chubby 50-year-old dudes that look kind of like me with a sad face.
It's great.
Well, did you buy Rumors?
I have Rumors, sure.
You like it?
Yeah.
Where'd you grow up, buddy?
I was born in LA here, but then moved to Laguna Beach when I was like 9 or so.
Yeah.
So spent those formative years there.
In Laguna Beach?
Down in Orange County, yeah.
On the beach?
On the beach.
So was that where Ty, is that where you met Ty?
Yeah, we went to high school together.
You and Ty Siegel went to high school together.
Yeah.
See, this is like, the weird thing about you guys is that like a lot of people don't know you guys or your music, but you're not even 30 and you have like 50 records out between the two of you. Do you ever just think about that?
It's kind of gotten really lucky to just like stay busy and eventually have people just want to release, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it's weird. When I first saw you or pictures of you or when I saw you play with Ty at the Echo that one time I was there.
Oh, yeah.
I assumed you're like, because you had your long hair and some scruff, that you seem to have sort of an ageless demeanor, and I decided you're like the old wizard, but it turns out you cut your hair and you're just a punk like the rest of them.
I'm just a dude.
I like
the ageless wizard, though. That's amazing.
Well, yeah, because you know, you sort of showed up on you know, a lot of Ty stuff, and Ty, you know, I got into him, I guess, a couple years ago. So when you guys are coming up, you're all in high school, and I don't even, I'm afraid to ask what year that is. What is it, like 98, 2000?
When do you? I graduated in 2004.
Oh my God.
Ty was 03.
Right. Yeah. So you're all down there in Laguna.
Yeah.
And who's the other guy that's on
Charles Moothart.
So what kind of shit are you listening to? What's the deal?
Back then, like in high school.
What brought you guys together?
I remember like, in the like early 2000s, we're kind of all listening to, well, there was like punk bands, you know, like Black Flag and
old stuff.
Yeah, but then there's also like the stuff that was coming out. There's a lot of like dance punk.
Yeah,
Moving Units.
Uh-huh.
And The Rapture.
Okay,
just kind of like a disco beat.
Right,
that got really hip for a second.
Really?
Yeah,
God, I missed everything.
I mean, that was a quick thing, but
I was already old and sad by then.
Yeah, but we all kind of listened to that, and then Ty already had a band, like a duo band, where he'd play drums and sing, and then our other friend played like bass and keyboard at the same time and sang, and he kind of had like a, I love this guy, but he had a pretty like affected Tom Waitsy voice.
Oh, really?
For like a 16-year-old. Yeah. He's amazing. He's awesome. And it was kind of, there's a lot of like that disco kind of punk thing going on.
Really?
Yeah, a little bit. It was called The Love This, and they would play, they were like, there was not a lot of music going on at our high school. It was really small. Or in our town, there was no really place.
What
no
town?
Place
to it was play. Laguna?
Laguna, yeah.
Really? So it was just all happening at the school and at people's houses?
It was just like house parties, like high school parties. So they would be like the resident band. And then, so I was already a fan, and then word got around. I played saxophone in the school band, like the marching band and the jazz band.
Was that your first instrument?
That was from when I was 10.
You played sax because your folks were like, why don't you play an instrument?
Yeah, well, my mom's a musician, so she started me out and my siblings on piano pretty early.
Professional musician?
No, she could be. She just retired, but she was she's an ER doctor at Cedars-Sinai.
Up here?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So she would commute a couple times a week from South Orange County.
Oh, to do the all-night shift kind of thing?
No. You know, she had, like, decent shifts by the end.
Mm-hmm.
But
so she was, like, an internist or, like, just a general doctor?
I think general
doctor. Yeah, yeah, one of those guys, people.
Darling, dealing with all the gnarly shit.
Yeah, comes in.
Yeah.
That guy's in trouble. Yeah.
It's brutal. But, I mean,
what'd your dad do?
He just retired as well, but he was a lawyer.
Wow.
Yeah. Smart people.
You're doing all right down there.
This is fine.
Was it a hard upbringing?
No, I mean.
How many siblings you got?
I got three others.
What are they?
They're
human.
They're all smart people.
Really?
I have my older sister is less than a year older than me, so we're Irish twins, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
I guess that's
just slang. One followed the other.
Boom. Yeah.
Yeah.
Within like 11 months and a couple days.
And then you got what, brothers or they're
all?
Yeah,
I got a younger brother. It's like 15 months younger.
Wow.
My parents went quick.
Just knocked him out.
Yeah.
Let's get this over with.
And he graduated law school.
Wow.
So he's working at a firm. My youngest sister just moved to LA to go to law school.
They're all doing that.
Yeah. And then there's me.
Yeah.
Doing this thing.
Well, how do your folks feel about that?
They're really supportive.
Really?
Yeah. Especially now that, I mean, for a while, my mom was always supportive because she's a musician. She kind of lived vicarious. Oh, she plays piano and harp. She plays like classical.
There's music. A harp in the house?
Yeah.
A big harp?
Big harp.
And she can do it?
She shreds, yeah.
Wow. So you grew up plinking around on a harp?
Yeah, a little bit. Try not to break it. Try not to tip it over. I kind of regret not learning harp.
Do you think it's too late? Michael,
I don't know.
It's never too late to learn.
I can plunk
harp.
Around. I understand it.
Really?
But it's not, you can't apply it very well, you know?
Right. I think, isn't there one groovy harp player?
Well, Joanna Newsom.
Joanna Newsom, yeah, she's great. That's right. She's the harp player.
Yeah.
She married Andy Samberg.
She did.
All right, so you're playing, so she gets you on saxophone.
Yeah.
So you know how to read music.
Yeah.
And what kind of music you playing on sax? Were you kind of, did you get involved? Did you get interested in jazz or just marching band?
I mean, I did. They had like a kind of big band style,
right?
You know, high school
sure.
jazz band, yeah. which I really liked. And I played like the lead, so I got the solos and stuff.
Oh yeah, so you could do it, huh?
Yeah, and like it was kind of an unsaid rule that you had to be to play in the jazz band. You kind of had to be in the marching band because it was the same kids, and I hated marching band. It's terrible, man.
So you were in the marching band.
Yeah.
But that was just the price you had to pay to do some leads, huh?
Yeah.
That was the only thing that kept you in. It's like, I'm the main sax dude. I guess I got to go out and do this dumb parade.
I got to play the baritone sax in the marching band, which...
That's the big one?
It's heavy as shit, but
yeah.
it's awesome. It's got the best range, just low, like honk.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And did you do parades and shit?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And stupid little capes and shit. I don't know.
Didn't you get any flack from that cool guy?
I was never a cool guy. No? I fit right into that band.
Oh.
I was not the cool guy.
You weren't?
But I hung out with the nerds and the...
The band nerds?
Yeah, a couple of them. Or like the computer nerds and then eventually like the skateboarders and then like the punks. You know.
So you went from computer nerds and then somebody turned you on to some drugs and then you're like, I gotta go.
And I was clean. I was totally clean living until, my 20s. I guess.
Really?
I still haven't, I don't do a lot of drugs or anything.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I'm not judging you. I'm not going to be like, really, what a puss. Why not, man?
No, I was just, I don't know, doing my thing.
But like, how's that blow up though like that? Because you're doing saxophone, you're in a marching band, you're wearing capes. What changes? What blows your mind into playing the bass and then doing punk rock? Like what was the moment? Do you remember?
I mean, it was really like joining that high school band with Ty and Coleman, the Love This. It was
So you saw them at a party and
yeah.
you were like these
well,
guys.
And I was getting to know like Ty a little bit.
What was he like when he was younger? Because you guys are both pretty soft-spoken, but it seems like you were kind of,
I mean, he's a madman.
He is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I know he was soft-spoken in here. I heard the interview. But
I didn't get the real tie, goddammit.
Well, no, that was the real, you got the real guy.
The sweet guy?
He's got one side of the coin.
Right. Well, when he gets on stage, he seems like a guy that just sort of comes to life up there.
Yeah.
Like that's how he, that's what he, that, where he lives it out.
He fits.
Yeah, yeah. There. Like, yeah, yeah. He becomes a guitar hero.
Yeah. So, it kind of felt like an old movie or something because I heard word that like, oh, the Love This kind of wants a saxophone player.
I think, a sax player.
Yeah. so, and then I remember, like, I think I was 17.
Yeah.
I was probably 16. School ends. We're in the parking lot. See him walk over. He's like, hey, man, do you want to? We're looking for a sax player. It kind of felt like, hey, Kat, come jam. Come sit in with us.
Yeah,
I was like, yeah, of course. And then just went over a couple of days later and joined the band as the third.
Into someone's house? Who, at Ty's house? Or where did you
go? I was played at Coleman's like garage.
Yeah.
Kind of basement garage.
Right.
And that was kind of my first time being in a band.
But
did
you jam?
I knew their songs, you know, because I saw them so many times. So I just kind of jammed over it, you know.
Uh-huh. So they were a real thing. Like, you saw them many times at many parties.
Yeah, a couple times. I mean, they were
cool.
They would strictly, they wouldn't go out and play any like public shows or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, none of us knew how to do that at all.
Well, what are you, like 17, 16?
Yeah. But there's just no, you know, there's no other bands like going to play gigs around town or anything. So
no one comes through?
Not Laguna, no.
So how'd you...
Like, we'd have to go, come up to L.A. usually.
Did you guys make the trip sometimes?
Yeah, we started going to the Smell a lot downtown.
Yeah.
You know that place?
No.
It's like a all-ages DIY space that's been around for years and years.
Oh, yeah?
And that's where all the first shows I saw were, and that's where all my bands would play for the first time. They were very open.
Sure. Like, well, the all ages thing for the punk rock thing was huge.
Yeah. I mean, it was like $5 usually.
They knew who their audience was.
Yeah.
Gotta get the kids in here.
It's all kids, and there's a whole strong scene about it.
Now, like, it's at some point, like, I've talked to Ty a couple times over permanent and shit, and, you know, he's turned me on to records. Well, it just seems like there's this garage psych sound that is popular, or at least, you know, like the thing.
Sure.
There's another LA band that does sort of like even more kind of, you know, lyrical, less garage, more psych sounding.
Is it Wand?
Yeah, Wand.
Yeah, those are buddies of mine.
Yeah.
They're amazing. They're my favorite band.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Are you guys all the same age?
Yeah, a little younger.
They're younger, or you're younger?
They're a little younger, but we're around the same age. Kids keep.
Oh my god, you're already there. These kids.
Yeah, but me and the main songwriter, Corey Hansen, we went to college together up at CalArts.
Yeah,
And we were roommates for a couple of years. So it's really good to see him like have a band that everyone loves, and because he's so talented and like. The songs are amazing. Like, the whole vibe of that music.
Yeah,
well,
I think Lance and Liz turned me on to them. I don't know what I'd do without Lance and Liz. I missed about 30 years of music somehow. And then, like, happens. They, yeah. But the weird thing is this like that record I played for you in there, is that now, you know, music nerds and record nerds are going back into catalogs of completely off, you know, non-mainstream, off-the-grid people that were on big labels,
yeah.
But you would never know their shit,
sure.
Really, or their B-sides. And then you start to realize like, how much of a fucking stronghold mainstream music business had on all of our brains.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way you're going to get turned on to that shit unless someone goes, dude.
Yeah. Because they just pump the same shit over the radio all the time.
Right, but there's thousands of fucking records out there of the same time, even. At any time in history of music, of unheard people.
Yeah. I mean, like, thank God for the internet for that reason alone. Or record store clerks.
Right.
You know, I was living back in Laguna, like, after high school, and then, and late in high school, I used to have shows at my parents' house. They would allow that, so it would just be like, those bands and
at your parents' house, you
at
would
my parents'
you
house.
Would sort of be the host.
I'd be the host.
How many bands?
The thing was like people would start. There was no, you know, there's no real outlet for music, and then eventually there's a bunch of music kids, and so everyone would start a band like for these shows and play like two or three songs,
right?
And it was just the same group of like 10 people, like
would mix and match,
yeah.
Different bands.
So there would be like, I don't know, 10 to 15 bands per night, you know, just...
Mix it, but the same 10 dudes or
pretty
women,
much.
And you just kind of...
Yeah.
Because you guys still do that.
Yeah, I guess so. It's more fun that way.
Well, I mean...
It's more fun just to like...
But see, that I think that's a relatively new thing. with your crew of guys, it seems. I mean, there was a lot of studio guys that show up on a lot of different albums,
oh,
but
sure.
It seems like all of you guys, like even on that Meat, the what's that record I just got? The
Meat Bodies?
The Meat Bodies. Like, you can hear Ty all over that thing. If he's not in there, it sounds like that he's some influence. Doesn't he play a little on that?
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Yeah, he plays some drums, I think.
Yeah, but it's just, but there's a sound to it. But it's interesting that that whole idea, and I imagine it's not that different, but I haven't heard it from talking to musicians, where you guys were just kids, you had no outlet. So your parents, thank God, were like, you can have your friends over to play music.
They're amazing about that, yeah.
And you would have these parties that didn't get out of control?
No, everyone would kind of keep each other in check. There wasn't even a lot of like drinking or drugging or anything. It was just like very positive.
What a respectful bunch of kids you all were.
Tried to be. I mean, of course there would be problems and the cops would come all the time.
Just the loudness? From,
yeah. And I would like try to tell my neighbors, like write little notes being like, we're going to have a little birthday party.
You should have said, we're doing something very important musically next door. We're building a generation of psych rockers and punks. Like,
stay off our backs, man.
Yeah, man.
Jesus.
So 10 of you just interchanging bands. And did all the bands sound different?
Yeah, kind of. I remember me and Ty played in this metal band called Goat Herder. It was like a thrash metal band.
Mm-hmm.
Where like me and him would both switch off on bass and drums and like try to do double kick drum,
and
we
you?
Had like four songs that, but it'd always go crazy, and like the singer Tom would like spit, he'd get like what is that, Bacardi 151 or something,
flame it,
have a tiki torch, and we're all wearing like Hawaiian shirts and shorts, and then you'd spit fire inside the house.
And that was as bad as it got.
Yeah, there was always this like this little window by the door that somebody would amazingly never get hurt, but inevitably somebody would fall through that little window. And it was like on ground floor, you know, it's like a platted window. So I would always just the next day have to go and buy like plates of glass and replace that, but that's about it, like it's out of control.
So I had one party at my house with two bands when I was a kid because my parents let me, they were out of town, and I turned the entire house into like a club, and it just packed out.
Uh-huh.
It was a disaster. At the end of the night, there was a very obese naked woman in the hot tub that we couldn't get to leave. That's how that ended.
That nobody
up.
Knew
yeah probably. No, of course not. Who'd you come with? I don't know.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, okay.
I saw a light.
So when did you guys get turned on to the bands that influenced you, really? I mean, like, because it, like, yeah, I know that, like, I didn't even know who the fuck Hawkwind was until Ty told me, and then you get into that catalog, and it's like, oh my God, there's 100 records.
Yeah, sure.
Who started sort of, like, tapping into some of that older shit that defines some of your sounds now?
You know, I was always really late to, like, rock. There wasn't really any like rock music at all in my house. My parents were like my mom was a classical musician.
Right.
And so there'd be like light classical and smooth jazz.
Right.
My dad would listen to like conservative talk radio in the car.
No. Rush Limbaugh and his long pauses.
Oh my God.
So you grew up with the conservative mindset.
Yeah. So I didn't know what rock music was really. And I remember, I think I was like eight or nine. I was like, none of my siblings weren't really into music too much either.
Oh my God. So you just had the harp and the piano and your sax and Rush Limbaugh.
I remember going to like the public library. So I'm like, I want to check out rock music. What's rock music?
Really?
I went.
You said that to the librarian?
No, I wandered over to the cassettes.
Yeah.
I had a bunch of cassettes.
How old were you?
I think I was 8 or 9.
Yeah.
I just picked one out, and it was like, you know, guy with long hair and a guitar shredding. I was like, oh, this looks like rock music. I take it home and listen to it, and it's like, I forget what it was. It was like the Scorpions or something. It was like some hair metal crazy ridiculous shit. And then, but then I had this.
Did it make an impact?
I think that one didn't stick.
Thank
but
God, dude,
pretty been... soon after that, we had this when we moved to Laguna. We had this.
Scorpions weren't horrible, but you know what I mean.
No.
Yeah, but it wasn't.
It was worse than Scorpions. It was something.
All right.
It was something worse.
Queensryche. I don't even know what they do.
I don't know.
So okay.
But
so
I had this. I had this cool babysitter type. We weren't babies, but he would like my parents worked, so he'd like pick us up from school. And right. He was a lifeguard.
Yeah.
We had a string of lifeguard like babysitter people for some reason.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You might want to talk to your mom about that.
Yeah, but then he would pick us up from school, and he introduced me to Nirvana.
Really?
That was my first favorite band. I was like 10 or 11. Like, so I immediately bought everything I could. And like,
right.
That really changed. That really like changed everything for me.
So that was probably when the last Nevermind came out?
It was actually like right, it would be right after he died.
So, oh, really?
It would be like, I forget when he died, but it would have been like 95 or 96.
Right. And that did it, huh?
That did it.
Thank God for that guy.
Yeah.
Lifeguard saved your life. He gave you Nirvana.
It was amazing. I remember like totally, I didn't see anything funny about it at all, but we were listening to it, and it's like, oh man, I want to start a band that sounds like Nirvana. I think I'm going to call it Nirvana 2.
Did you do that?
I still plan to someday. Because I love it. I didn't see...
Those big shoes to fill, buddy.
I remember him laughing. And who? Like, I didn't... Just the babysitter lifeguard.
Oh, when you said that?
And Nirvana, too.
Yeah.
And now, yeah.
And now, what, you were like 10?
Yeah.
Yeah. He must have thought it was hilarious. Because it was probably an earnest idea.
No, it was like, why wouldn't I call it Nirvana, too? I love Nirvana. and then I got into like Metallica.
Really? You went from Nirvana and Metallica? Because I never went Metallica, but a lot of people go Metallica.
Yeah, those early records are really cool.
No, they're great because they sort of like, both of those bands kind of annihilate that kind of blues base of most rock and roll. Like, they kind of go their own way.
Sure. Yeah.
Like the Nirvana stuff, that's all pop chords. A lot of them, you know, kind of sad, almost Beatles-y.
It's Beatles worship.
Right.
Like through a Big Muff.
Yeah. And Metallica, like, I don't even know what the fuck that is as far as progressions are. Where'd that come from?
I don't even know. It's just shredding.
But like, there's no 1-4-5 kind of chorusing. There's its own world.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those were the two. Those were the defining factors.
Yeah, and there was like Green Day and like, you know, like kind of really The Offspring.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Dude, I've actually been, the last week or so,
mm-hmm.
been going back and listening to old Offspring.
Really?
Yeah. I'm like really into it. Just blasting down the freeway. It's cool, like Smash.
Yeah, record. Yeah.
I don't know. I just like that.
And when did you get into like some of the psych rock stuff? Was that Ty?
That was Ty and that group of friends. Really,
they were into it.
It was really like late high school that I started getting into some of the music that I still listen to, or you know, like garage rock and some punk stuff and stuff. It took that group of friends to. I finally had like music friends.
Right.
You know.
And when did you decide to go to CalArts? How did that, like, did you pull out of like all those high school bands? And then where is that place?
It's up in Valencia.
And so that was a commute, or did you live up there?
I lived up there. That was years after high school, actually. I bounced around before. I like went up to Portland immediately after high school.
And which bands were you in up there? Let's go through
the... bands.
No bands?
No bands.
Which is, was it a chick?
No, it was school.
Oh.
It was like a college.
Oh, but, you went to college in Portland?
Yeah, and I kind of thought...
Done with music?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I didn't get this direct pressure from my family, but you know, as they're all
lawyers,
know, like, academic,
and,
like...
Doctors and lawyers.
Brilliant people. Yeah. So, I mean, they weren't like, you need to cut out music and get
right.
go to school and get a real job.
Right.
But I felt that like on my own.
Right.
So I kind of started trying to study.
How long did that last, bud?
Not very long.
A year?
Yeah. It was a crazy time up there.
Just get depressed?
Yeah. Yeah. I had a, it's actually, yeah, there's the story of that time is like kind of the B side of my last record. MC3. It's
really?
Kind of like a mini, it's like a narrative, a mini concept record.
The second side of Michael Cronin 3.
Yeah, it's the first like through line series of songs I've done.
What was that through line?
It was, I mean, I was up there, I was in school. It was like a tough school. I didn't really, it was just like, I had no idea what I was doing. I just like, I need to graduate school and get a job. I wasn't playing music.
So you just sort of like, okay, high school's done. Now I've got to focus and do what I'm expected to, or what cultural, there's cultural expectations.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, I do want to stress, because I know they'll listen. It wasn't like my folks that were.
Right. No, it was just sort of like, this is what people do.
And that's what people did. That's right. What like all my high school friends did.
Orange County, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like,
I guess that's right. That's, I don't need to pigeonhole it. That's just what you do when you come from people that are educated.
No, sure.
You assume
you get
that,
educated.
Right. You assume it's time to do this.
And
so,
there's a time where I was just like, kind of something was wrong. I wasn't doing something right. You know,
it's a little vague, Michael.
I know it was vague.
Really?
But
you just didn't feel right.
I didn't feel right. I started like, you know, getting depressed and anxious for the first time.
Oh yeah, like anxiety attacks.
Yeah, I had a few of those for the first time. I was just like outside of my bubble. I grew up in such a bubble. Like,
right, and you had friends and everything. Now you're up in Portland, where it's dark and weird, and the town has a certain vibe to it. And you're with the, you know, I imagine fairly rich kids from all over the world.
Sure.
That seem to have more of their shit together. That kind of thing.
Yeah, and like at the same time, like I developed this like. Create this really bad back injury from years of like, you know, skateboarding and stuff. It turned out I slipped a disc, but I had I just felt it in my like leg.
Yeah, sciatica.
I thought it was coming on slowly, and I thought I like pulled a hamstring or something.
Yeah,
and it got worse and worse and worse to the point where like couldn't even really like walk anymore.
And this is your first year of college?
This is the second year.
And now you're like not only uncomfortable, but you can't leave your room?
Yeah.
And you're limping around.
I would limp around like literally like an old man, like that speed. And I was just like on a bunch of painkillers, and I was just like unhappy and like.
Did you have friends?
I had friends.
That's good.
And they were good, like interesting people. And it was like a classic thing where like my worldview was getting expanded.
Yeah.
In, you know, first year of college or whatever.
That's good.
But like so much was wrong, and something was like very wrong, and physically I was all fucked up.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that just fed into like depression, anxiety, and like, what am I even doing here?
And did you have a breakdown?
Yeah. I had a snapping point.
Called the parents.
Yeah, well, you know, the first time I was going to doctors up there, and they're like, okay, figured out like I slipped a disc and it's bad.
Right.
And then my parents were looking into like
surgery.
She's
a doctor, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like you don't often have to go to surgery for that thing. Sometimes you can work it out on your own.
Yeah.
But apparently mine was so far blown out that like I needed to get surgery.
Oh.
So I was all fucked up. And then there was like this really long waiting list for some reason.
Really?
Yeah.
Even with the old lady being a doctor?
I couldn't get in. But then...
Usually doctors are like, let's go to Bob.
Yeah. I don't know. But then I still don't know if she pulled some strings or something. But I got a call on like, let's say a Saturday, being like, you need to get here by Monday. You're going to have surgery.
To LA.
Yeah. Like we fit you in.
Right.
I was like, oh, okay, sure. And I was already like, so, you know, I was so blurry on like painkillers and so much like chronic pain. It was like a chronic pain, which is a crazy thing to deal with.
Yeah. Horrible.
Yeah. It's hard to describe.
You just try to like, your brain keeps trying to live with it, but you can't.
Yeah, it's just like,
right.
So I couldn't concentrate. So I was like kind of failing out of all my classes anyway. And my social life was kind of falling apart. So I was like, okay, I had my car. So I just loaded up my stuff in my car.
All of it.
Yeah. I didn't have much stuff, you know.
But you were like, I'm done with school. It wasn't like I'm coming back here.
Well, I wasn't sure at that time, but I had to leave. I couldn't tell anyone. I didn't tell anyone at the school, or it's only told like a couple friends. Just like, I'm gone. And then so I was gone. I had surgery, and then I was like laid up in bed for a long time.
Yeah,
like now really just kind of like, what the fuck am I going to do? I'm like laid out in bed. I'm like in school, but I hate it.
Yeah.
Something's wrong.
So you had a lot of time to think.
Yeah. And then I recovered. I tried to go back to school for a little bit, but yeah. I was still like depressed and fucked up. So
right.
I left. I went back to Laguna.
Were you lost or were you happy to be home?
I was lost, but like the silver, I mean, in retrospect, because that was like 10 years ago, but in retrospect, that was like one of the best things that ever happened to me because I was home. I was like aimless. It's like something's wrong. And then my friends are like, hey, do you want to just come over and play music in our basement? And like join our band? I was like, yeah, sure. They're like, can you play bass? I'm like, I could probably learn bass. I don't know. And then so we started playing music and I started like writing music for the first time.
Who were those friends? Was that Ty?
The first band in that period I joined was with this guy, that guy Charles Moothart.
From Tom White's voice.
No.
The other guy from Fuzz.
From Fuzz. He's the guitar player.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah.
And some other old high school friends. And we started a band.
Did it have a name?
Turned into Moonhearts.
Oh, okay.
Who I've like
Charlie released. And the Moonhearts?
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't find those records.
They're kinda hard to find. I'll bring you one if you want. It's fun. It's pretty, you know, it's garage rock.
Uh-huh.
Pretty like aggressive, like some surf in there.
So that saved you.
I feel like it, in retrospect, I was just going with it, but it was really important.
And you started writing songs?
I started writing songs. I started singing. They're like, we jammed out something.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, who's going to sing in this band? And like, nobody wanted to do it.
Right.
And I'd never like sung before. I was like, I'll take it. I'll give it a shot. I don't know. I'll write some lyrics.
Yeah.
I like sang for the first time. I remember we recorded like in GarageBand down in the basement. I came back the next day with lyrics and a melody I'd written.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, you guys, everyone out of the room, like go outside. I don't want you to hear this.
Yeah.
Like me doing my first vocal take ever.
Yeah.
And I did it and there, you know, it wasn't good. I've heard it since. It was pretty awful, but they were just like, oh, that's great, man. You're the singer now. And I was like, shit.
There you go.
So I'm not
welcome
like
to rock and roll.
Yeah.
Singer.
I mean, I was excited to like write the songs and the melodies and the lyrics and stuff, but like I'm always like the shy guy.
Yeah.
Like
bass player.
I'm getting out of it now.
Yeah.
Like as in my late 20s or whatever. But like in high school, like I didn't talk to anybody except for my friends. I was so painfully shy. So the idea of like singing in a band was insane.
Yeah.
But yeah, that whole process like really helped me like just in my normal life, like get out of my shell a little more too.
That's great, man.
So yeah, it was like a crazy.
So that was the first band, Charlie and the Moonhearts.
Yeah.
And then like that, so that started the rock career in a way.
Yeah, I guess so. And we were just like having fun. There's absolutely no ambition other than just like, let's play some shows. And if we can record, if we can figure out how to record something, that'd be awesome.
Right.
Then we could just make like cassette tapes and like.
That was the thing, huh?
Yeah. I mean, that was all we could really do. We could do CDRs.
Right.
Or we could do
cassette
tapes. You couldn't
sort of mass run them off.
No, yeah, right. I just found, because I just moved a couple of days ago into this area, I found some of the first like Moonhearts demo tapes, and they're just, you know, I now know that there's like shorter lengths of tapes that
right.
would fit the music better.
Right.
But they're all just like 90-minute tapes with like four songs on it, five songs, and all that. I just hand drew the covers with like stupid hearts and stars and like glitter.
And what was the plan with those? You just to give them to fans, but there was no idea of like how do we make records?
No idea.
But I think like, okay, so this is sort of what's interesting to me is that, okay, so you're making these glittery cassette tapes. You're with this band, Charlie and the Moonhearts.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing shit. You feel like you have something. You sounded different than other people, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to.
Yeah. What was the sound?
I mean, it was like definitely based in garage punk.
Punk surfy kind of.
Yeah, we're listening to a lot of like the Mummies and like the Gories and the Oblivions. And,
right,
like,
right. So how does it, because you know, you look at you or Ty and you record on at least three or four, maybe five record labels over the course of 5 or 6 years. I mean, where, how do you get from making glittery 90-minute cassettes with four songs on them to sort of, you know, wondering how or trying to make a living, you know, on record?
Yeah, it's so hard to, I don't even know. I mean, it was such a slow burn of just no expectations and like starting to, you know, play bigger shows, and then like an Italian guy with like a small record label that would just print like 300 black and white 7-inches.
Right.
Contacted me on MySpace at the time.
Yeah.
Just like in broken English, do you want to make a 7-inch? And I was like, yes, of course. That's my dream. Like,
right.
I never.
So was MySpace important to you? I mean, did that.
It was crazy. That was the way we like mostly booked shows.
So you'd put music up on MySpace.
Yeah.
And you had a page.
Yeah. And then you'd find other bands and they'd find you and they'd be like, you know, do you want to play this show? Do you want to play this party?
Really?
Yeah.
So that sort of replaced the weird kind of fanzine, you know, writing letters that the old punk rockers did. That, you know, you'd write a letter to a guy in a band or call him.
Sure.
To try to book a gig with some other punk bands. So MySpace really functioned that way.
Yeah. It's funny because MySpace is gone. All these things
gone.
They're going to be gone. But it was really important.
Yeah.
It's like how we got our first couple records made
with the Italian guy.
The Italian guy.
And who was the next record?
This was on MySpace too. Like this record label Tic Tac Totally out of Chicago.
Uh-huh.
Just a small label, like one dude working out of his garage.
Now, were you finding that you were building a fan base?
Yeah, I mean, slowly but surely, and we started being able to play shows like out of town, play in LA, like
at Smell.
I think that was one of our first shows. Our first show was at my house.
Yeah, of course.
And that was also
the most popular venue in Laguna Beach.
That was the place to be. The Cronin shows, as they would be called.
So what made you decide to go to CalArts in the middle of all this?
I eventually figured out that like maybe I should go to school and graduate.
From something.
Yeah, because I still playing all these shows, like, I'm not going to be a professional musician because, like, how do you even do that? Like, how do you make a living? You know, I just thought
that the way to do that was to go to school.
I didn't even think that. I was just I'm going to go to school, and the only way I could get through school and get, like, a degree would be to play music there.
Right.
You know? And it's a cool school. It's, like, really experimental.
Yeah.
It's, like, basically, the John Cage School of Music.
Really?
Yeah.
So you started getting into that. So what'd you learn there? Is it really the John Cage School of Music? Did he start it? Or
no,
was it,
I mean, but all the professors were like contemporaries.
Sure, sure.
So it was that.
Contemporaries of John Cage? Or?
Yeah, they would play his, you know, they'd play his stuff, and they're all like.
Yeah, a lot of waiting with the John Cage.
Yeah, a lot of silence. 4:33. But it was really cool because they were just really out there. And it wasn't like a straight conservatory. Like,
right.
I would never be able to. I mean, I auditioned. The way I auditioned was like with saxophone, because it was the only. I didn't play a lot of saxophone at that time. I was mostly like playing in punk bands, but I was like, that's the only one I can read on.
Right.
So I think I played like a Bach piece. I brought my mom up to audition with me.
Yeah.
So she
backed you?
Yeah. She played piano.
She played piano?
And I wrote like a piece for saxophone and harp.
Uh huh. Did she play harp too?
She played harp too.
She brought the harp up and they had a piano there? Yeah.
Yeah.
And you did two pieces?
And then we did a third one that was kind of like a Eastern European, like fast kind of klezmer piece with like piano and I'm playing saxophone.
And it's you and your mom?
It's me and my mom.
But there was never a moment there where you're like, we should get this on record.
I think we recorded one of them, but it's just kind of a schmaltzy like piano harp piece.
Oh, that's sweet.
But I'm still trying to get her on a record somehow. I don't know how to tie a harp into my music yet, but it'll happen.
You'll figure it out.
Yeah.
It sounded like the window to do that would have been when you were at CalArts.
Sure. It was mostly like 3 years of critically thinking about and playing music like all the time.
All kinds.
Yeah. So no matter, a lot of people, it seems a lot of musicians, there's still a cliche about like, if you go to music school, you'll lose all your like spontaneity and kind of, you know, they say it kills something in you as a musician.
I don't know, but you entered without the illusion of being some sort of concert saxophone player. I mean, you'd already been in the trenches in a way.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound like it's a noodle school. Like, you know, I mean, Berkeley, I think, you know, different musical schools produce different types of people.
Sure.
And it seems like this one was more completely creative. And you could find the education you wanted, whereas, you know, you weren't being trained to be a proficient studio musician.
Yeah, it was more just expanding your mind about what music is and what it can be than, like, there's still amazing, like, session musicians that come out of there.
Right.
Of course.
Yeah, of course.
Just with a broader sense of, like, what they can do on their instrument or what they can do with music generally.
Well, maybe that's what they were setting out to do. You were setting out to be a rock guy.
Yeah, I guess so.
You know?
And I kind of,
And you returned to it.
I returned to it. Like, I graduated and, like, a few days later went on tour up the West Coast.
Did you make a record?
There's a record. We have a one-sided 12-inch record.
And so you did that right out of school because you guys were in it.
Yeah, so it just, I mean, that was about it for me because I did that tour immediately. Jumped in the van with Ty as soon as I got back to LA or San Francisco or something.
And he was like, dude.
He's like, you're back in the band. I played in like early incarnations of his band as like Ty Siegel.
Right.
And then he was up in San Francisco. I was down in LA at school.
Reverse Shark Attack?
We did that. Yeah, we did that. When was that?
2009.
Yeah. We recorded that just at my parents' house when I was living in Orange County. In
the famous Cronin studio?
Yeah.
It was, and performance space?
It was a garage band with one mic,
yeah,
one amp, a drum set, guitar, bass.
He likes that though.
Yeah.
I mean, it worked out. Real organic with that shit, you know. The last record seemed to be a little more production.
Yeah, it sounds great.
Yeah, yeah.
Chris Woodhouse. Yeah, that was fun. That guy does some amazing work.
Were you on that record?
Manipulator? Yeah, I did the string arrangements. And then played on a song. I played bass on a song.
So you are the wizard. You're like the guy, you're like, get Cronin in here. We got to get some, we can need a French horn.
If you need a French horn, and then call
some
me.
Cellos.
Or a saxophone player. You know, yeah. I've played sax on so many, you know, up in San Francisco bands or down here, whatever. I played saxophone on so many songs that's always the same thing. They're like, all right, here's your solo. Do something melodic for like four bars and then just go squeak.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I know how to do that. That's on all your friends' records that I've ever been on.
So you were in the Bay Area for a while?
Yeah. So I, that tour actually, graduated school. I had like a duffel bag in my bass.
Yeah.
Jumped in the van with Ty with no break. Went on another West Coast tour with him. Ended up in San Francisco and just stayed.
That's where he was?
Yeah, that's where him and most of the friends I grew up playing music with were. And he was already like...
They were all in the Bay Area defining themselves. So, okay, but the point is that you guys were all working and making records on whatever label would have you, and you were playing on everyone's records.
Yeah, and at that time, by the time I moved to San Francisco, like I haven't had a like a proper job since.
Yeah.
Because we just started touring like maniacs, and like we were all recording... You know, we weren't making money off the recordings at all, but we're just touring like crazy for the last, like, you know, four years or whatever.
And now you're both, like, I saw you play with him, and you tour with him sometimes or always when it's a Ty Siegel band?
Always, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, up in, like, since that time, about 4 years ago when I, like, rejoined.
And then it strikes me that I guess we should probably get into the three solo records because... The first Michael Cronin records on Trouble in Mind?
Yeah.
That's a good label.
They're great. Yeah, I have to give them credit, Bill and Lisa Rowe.
Uh-huh.
Because I got to know them through touring through Chicago, played with their old band Coca-Cola mm-hmm. a few times. And we would like, they'd let us stay at their house and stuff.
Right.
So we were friends, and then I was coming through with Ty Siegel, and me and Bill were listening to music, and we're into the same kind of stuff. We're into these like psychedelic Del Shannon.
Yeah, records. That one. Yeah, that's a good record. The one that everyone knows. I just got that. Yeah.
So we were like connecting on that, and I was like, at that time, I was like, I've been thinking about like putting out some music under my own name, and I kind of want it to be something like this, you know,
like kind of psychedelic
yeah. pop.
Yeah.
And he was like, you definitely should. And I pretty much like 95% guarantee that if you send it to me, just record it, like we'll put it out. Like we're starting this new, it's kind of new early record label. So yeah. he's like, just do it. I'll put it out. Like, unless it's fucking terrible.
Right.
Of course I won't. But yeah. So that really like lit the fire under my ass to be like, okay, I'm going to collect all my musical worlds together and try to make this record under my own name.
And it just struck me because I only knew you and whatever I projected onto you from Ty's world.
Sure.
And then like these records, I'm like, holy shit, this is like full on production, big sounding, you know, pop music that really is like all of the songs were like just hit you in the head in a way where it's sort of like, this is beautifully realized. It didn't okay. seem like, you know, we're just kind of plinking around or fucking just like raw as fuck. It sounded like you produced those records.
Well, thanks. That's really nice. I tried. I worked hard on them. Yeah.
And the last one, it's sort of like one of these records where I'm like, this should be a huge record.
I don't know. I mean,
I'm sorry. It's not even a question, but like, I know the last two are on Merge and I like him and Mac and, you know, they've always been doing a lot of great stuff.
They're
but
awesome.
It's one of those records where I don't really know what the life of records is now, but it seems to me that it's very accessible. It's catchy, but it's also deep and it's got, you know, this amazing orchestration and stuff that like at another time, you're sort of like, this would be like a hit record.
Well, thank you. That's awesome. Yeah. It's amazing that people still want to hear like guitar music at all, you know?
There's a whole new generation of guys, and I think you guys and a lot of the people you're talking about are defining sort of this age of music that there's definitely, you know, the community of it is always mind-blowing to me that you guys all know each other and that you play with each other and that there's sort of this crew of people moving up with that are getting, you know, I mean, Ty's getting a lot of attention and now you're getting a lot of attention. And how did you get tied in with all the comedy people? Through Jonah?
Kind of, yeah. That was, I've gotten really into comedy the last couple of years.
Oh, yeah?
I guess, yeah.
Oh, good.
You know, it started out like...
Hanging around the Meltdown?
I've been there a few times. That's it's a good place.
Yeah.
I was touring so much, and I needed a break from music just in my head. Like, I would just be surrounded by music all the time. So I was like, should I listen to audiobooks? Should I do this? Like, what's a podcast?
Right.
So I was really late onto that, and then like... I started getting into a lot of podcasts, I've listened to for years, and a lot of comedy, and I started like learning about comedy through these podcasts, learning about people, and then I started going out to shows when I moved to LA, or once in a while in San Francisco, and then I got a Twitter. Comedians are all about Twitter, and then like,
you guys don't. I don't know what it is with musicians. Like, I get boxes of fucking records, and I'm like, this is a great record. I'm going to tweet this guy. He's like, no. Or if there is a tweet, it's from 3 years ago. Like, you just can't.
Yeah.
You don't see. You guys don't like. There's some part of you guys where it's sort of like, I'd rather not promote at all if that's possible. If there's a way that I could.
Yeah, I think it's fun. I don't. I'm bad at self promotion, but I do like reading comedians' tweets.
Well, it's good just to have a presence on there. So when one of us likes your shit.
It's there.
Yeah, and we can at least send you somewhere. And MySpace is over, bud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's how, like, I don't know. Jonah, I think, contacted me about,
did
like,
did you do his podcast?
I did a live one up in Portland.
Oh, okay.
But it didn't get recorded. they fucked up.
What about Jonah Radio? You haven't been on Jonah Radio?
That was that one.
I know, but you didn't do an interview, kind of hangout thing at his house?
No, I mean, I live a couple houses down from him now.
In Atwater? Or are you, that's right. He bought a house down here.
Yeah, he's down the street.
Everyone's down the street now. Well, he would probably like every band you mentioned that I'm like, what? He'd be like, oh, I love that record. I have that one.
Yeah.
Like, he's like that guy.
No,
he knows all the records. Well,
I started, you know, there's a couple comedians who liked my music and then I liked their stuff too. It's like him, like,
so the community's blend. Yeah, Bronner's great.
Yeah, so they both, Jonah and Kurt, both directed. There's two music videos.
Right. There's the one that's a rip on They Call Me Out, or Call Me Out, that one, and then I didn't watch the other one. That's Bronner, Jonah, a joint as well?
Well, not a joint, but they were both in it. Oh, but yeah. That was, Kurt directed that. Okay. And Kristen Schaal starred in it.
Oh, you're with all the groovy kids. This is a big groovy rock comedy crossover.
Yeah. I like it a lot. I got to play, you know, I've gotten to play a few comedy shows at like Nerd Melt or, I played a Kurt and Kristen show.
Oh yeah, down at the Virgil?
Yeah, I saw you do stand up there once when I just went.
How was that?
It's great.
I don't remember.
I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
I'm trying not to like geek out, but.
Well, I like whenever I do those rooms where it's full of like alt kids, there's part of me that's sort of like, I'm going to teach them a lesson.
I know, you're kind of yelling at everybody. I loved it. Oh, I kind of knew what to expect. And then
horrible.
I was like, yep, this is
exactly
what I wanted.
Well, let's play a song, man. You want to?
Sure.
Sometimes I get musicians in here like Richard Thompson or Nick Lowe, people like that. And I'm embarrassed about my setup, but like, this is like how you recorded half your life.
Like this is high tech for me. This is great.
Yeah. Great.
Thanks.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for
having me. Little Beals chord at the end.
Little Beals chord at the end. You got it, Charlie.
Good talking to you, man.
Thanks a lot.
Nice. I like when people play music in front of me. You can get Michael's music and stuff from Titus Andronicus and a lot of other shit. They got good stuff at Merge Records. Oh my God, I'm so fucked up on jet lag. All right, so go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Yeah? You know the deal. I'm too tired to play, but I think I gotta play.
Thank you.